One thing that was never given the same space in the media as the strike was the three-day conference that I called of the strike committee a week or two after the strike was over. And we held it in Vanguard headquarters, and it was the full committee, except the politicians. They were kept out of it. We told them we would give them a shout when we wanted them. And the whole concept was, how did we see Northern Ireland? What did we want for Northern Ireland? What did we want for our people in Northern Ireland? It might surprise you to know that it was the overwhelming, unanimous decision that we had to find a new way of governing Northern Ireland. And we had to find a new way of governing Northern Ireland which involved the two peoples of Northern Ireland. And we demanded that our politicians would go and find a settlement with the Gaelic representatives. We demanded that the paramilitaries would not be used again, and therefore don't be coming crying to us if you don't do it this time. That is the feeling of the ordinary working class representatives through the paramilitaries, the men who had continually done the dirty work, the men who finished up in jail while our politicians finished up in Stormont with fat wages. And of course, as I say, it's all very well doing the dirty work and doing the will of the politicians and allow them to exploit and manipulate you. But when you start to bite back, that's not what they want at all. I think that what was the strike about? It was a mixture. And I know that people have tried to put one caption on from time to time. It was about this, we didn't want Catholics in government. Yeah, there were those who didn't want Catholics in government. There were those who didn't mind Catholics in government, but they didn't want Republicans. There were those who wanted Stormont back with majority rule, as it was. And there were those who wanted Stormont back, but they wanted a whole new Stormont. To me, I still hold this view. It has institutionalised the divisions in our community. We have not seen the evolution of proper politics. And it's been a direct result of the decisions that have been taken by Westminster. And it's been a direct result of Westminster and the Irish government, but particularly Westminster, doing deals behind people's backs, which we've seen. And I've talked about this for the last 40 years. You cannot build a society if you go to one side and give them guarantees, because very quickly then you've got to go to the other side and give them guarantees. So you're trying to build things in guarantees. I argued with them beyond the religious divide that we have a new constitution, we have a new Bill of Rights, and it applies equally to every citizen of the state, protected by a Supreme Court, whose Supreme Court judge could be appointed by a friendly country such as the United States for a period of 10 years, and that we would try and allow our people to elect their representatives on purely political terms and not the donkey carrying the biggest union jack or the goat carrying the biggest tricolour. It's an indictment on us. It's an indictment of everybody that has brains in this country and a vision for this country to try and build a society in which we don't recognise that whatever we're doing is going to affect our children for generations to come. And if somebody had started positive politics 200 years ago, we mightn't have been in this bother anymore. We might have had a government up there in which the talents from our two communities can be pulled together to govern this country. And unless we find a way forward of allowing the evolution of proper politics to take place in this country, then we're damned for the rest of our lives. We're always going to be governed by the border. And I think that, you know, I said then, maybe it's too late, that if only we could convince our people that there's two winners and two losers in this situation. The Nationalists will lose out in their United Ireland, but they'll win out because the Brits are going. And the Loyalists will win out because of the fact there's going to be no United Ireland, but they lose out because the Brits are going. But every time we have a problem, and we said this in the 70s, and I said it after the Good Friday Agreement, when they all come out looking for their lawyers to see what they had agreed to, they didn't put any soul into that agreement. There was no heart in it. And every time one group was getting into bother, we should have been trying to help them get out of their troubles, not digging the hole bigger for them. And unless we can see that sort of a vision, that regardless of a man's political, a man's religious beliefs, that if he's the best person in the country to do a particular job, then that person, that man or that woman should get that job. And it's the same in government. And what we have at this moment in time is a system of government that only perpetuates the troubles. And I think it's only but right that each and every one of us plays our part in trying to change that. I'll leave you with a question I asked when we do our big programmes to Belgium, with young people in particular from both communities, and with the adults, but more particularly with the kids. If children are not born bigots, where do they come from? Who makes a bigot? How does a person become a bigot? And I'll bet you a penny to a penny there's not one of you in this room today could hold up your hand and say, I have contributed to that bigotry. Each and every one of us in our own capacity have contributed to that bigotry. The 74 strike was a time when loyalist people, after such a battering, lifted their head for a short period of time. And the only way in which we're going to get an agreement in this community is to remove the fears of the two communities by our actions. Not by just words, but by actions. We tried to do it in 1970, 77, 78, 79, when the UDA supported the document Beyond the Religious Divide, which was I had worked on for years before the organisation adopted it. And it became, out of the entire organisation estimated between 50,000 and 80,000 people, I insisted that whenever the document was finished, it had to be presented to the entire organisation. And I spent 9 months, 4 nights a week, went through all the various companies, battalions in the organisation, explaining what Beyond the Religious Divide was. I remember distinctly that I said to Andy, I'm going to pick the hardest company, because if I can convince them, they'll have no problem convincing the rest. And I asked to go up to Mayo Street in the Shankill, and there was 500 men in that room that night, and women. And no disrespect to the boys in the Shankill, but I'm telling about the boys with the busted nose and the busted eyes and the chopped up faces. And these were the hard men of the organisation. And I explained to them the situation. And one guy got up on his feet and he asked the one question. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to hear it or not, but I knew it and I wanted it. And he says, have you talked to the Tiggs? And everybody in the room was stunned. And I says, do you want me to talk to the Tiggs? He said, well, there's no effing reason, or there's no effing excuse. He says, coming up here to talk to us. If you haven't talked to the Tiggs and they don't buy it, so there's no sense in us buying it. He says, we'll buy it, he says, but you have to talk to the Tiggs. So we said about that, and yes, there was positive response coming from all parts of the country, but there was great fear. Great fear, because what I had done was put the thing together in a whole package. You cannot separate what your political proposals are from your constitution and everything else, and that's got to be a constitution. And the only fear I've always had in all of what I believed, and I'm sure that, you see, my eminent friend Ken's and he and Morris will know more than most. There's no such thing as economic stability without political stability. And there's no such thing as political stability without constitutional stability. And we have got to find a solution to our constitutional problem. That's first and foremost, because it unsettles all the other bits of government. And then we ask ourselves the final question. Can we have constitutional stability in religious and cultural unity without religious and cultural unity? And this is something we've got to ask ourselves. Can we really build a society in which you have a constitutional settlement, politics, and everything else? And we've set up institutions to defend we've set up forces of law and order to protect the institutions of the state. Because at no time can you create forces of law and order to maintain institutions that the people don't support. And therefore we've got to get institutions put into place that the people will support and in turn support their forces of law and order to maintain those institutions. You only have to look south of the border And every time there's been a problem south of the border, the guards have wheeled in with their batons and knocked hell at everybody, and I have never heard people in the Republic complaining. They support the forces of law and order to maintain the institutions. We've got to do the same here, and we haven't done it. We haven't even had the vision to do it. And I know that's right, because I spoke several years ago, 14 years ago to be exact, when I went to Canada, and I was visiting the First Nation people. And I got very friendly with one of the chief's sons. And we were out having a beer one night, and he was telling me about all the troubles and stuff that they have in the reservations. From didn't realize religion, and was drinking. I knew there was drinking drugs and stuff, but I didn't realize there was religious problems in the reservations. And I said to him, John, what is your thoughts for the future? He says, Glenn, what we do within our people, he says, we have to think in the seventh generation. And I said, what do you mean the seventh generation? He says, we don't think about making laws that will affect our people and our children or our grandchildren. He says, we think on how they will affect the seventh generation of our people. Now, that's vision. And sadly, I'm afraid to say that we're lacking that vision here in this province. And I think that the only way in which we're ever going to, if we want to survive, if we want to come through this, is we have to draw on the talents of our two communities, combined talents of our two communities, to get us through it. We can't do it on our own. The loyalists and ISIS can't do it on their own. And unless we accept the fact that this is a basic consideration for all of us, then we're going to go on the same way. And don't listen to what people are telling you about this is that solved and this is solved. It won't be solved, because in 10 years' time it'll start all up again. We've got to get back to the beginning. We've got to start from scratch. And we've got to pull on people with vision and people who can convince our others that this is the only way forward. And all I want to say is just thank you very much for the opportunity, and I'm going to get back into retirement again after this. Thank you very much.
Shortly we'll be having our second panel with Ken Bloomfield and Maurice Hayes, but I'm just going to, while Glenn's here, I'm just going to give 5 or 10 minutes just to have some questions that people have, or any brief contributions. Anybody?
Glenn, the interesting story for me is the one you told about sitting beside Craig in Stormont and looking across the benches at the SDLP tour and realising that they outstrip you in talent completely. And, you know, that surely, how do you explain that? How do you explain that loyalism failed to produce a political movement with intelligent and competent people who could appeal to a wide range of the electorate?
We've always had a problem in relation to the class thing within the Talks movement. We've got to deal with that. It's there. We run a theatre in the Waterside, 372-seater theatre that I have built for our people to practice their arts and get into the arts and stuff. With the Millennium Forum across the town, 1,000, which is run by the City Council. I have 2 primary schools sitting there, say, well, 4 or 5 Catholic ones, 2 Protestant ones. And before they'd come in to support the Waterside Theatre, they'll travel over to the Millennium Forum and they'll have to get buses to pick the kids there. So this class thing that, you know, whether it's Glenny Bar or whatever, who it is, but the Millennium Forum, that's a big thing run by the councils, therefore that's better. It doesn't any better programs on their own. There is a class thing, Malachy, as I said, that's the same as, you know, it's all right rubbing shoulders with Andy Terry during the 74 strike, but you wouldn't allow your daughter to marry one of us, you know, simple as that. And the SDLP were superb, and we find that the nationalist community can pull their people together, the talents of their people together, better than we can. And unfortunately, and no disrespect to the Orange Order and Apprentice Boys and all the rest of it, but you know, you get some old worshipful master, you know, and Huey Smith could have told you this as well. I remember distinctly that there was a decision taken by Hattie throw up in protest, get the Fokkerite unions and throw them out over the bar of the house, supposed to make some. And I remember Hugh and I were sitting together and the shout was given to throw somebody out. And Hugh and I rushed forward and the first person we met was Leslie Morrell. Does anybody know Leslie Morrell? Do you remember Leslie Morrell's about 6 foot six. He's a big farmer from County Derry. And I remember as well, Hugh and I looked at him with that, and we lifted from East Belfast, a wee old daughter man. He was about 70 odd years of age, so Hugh and me pushed him over there. But here were these old people that were there because of the worshipful master of an organisation or whatever. And we didn't even pick the talents from their own community to go in opposition to the SDLP. It was these gifts that were handed out for 50 years in the Orange Order or whatever. And it was an absolute disaster for us. And you look at Stormont today and you see the talent that's getting up on the Republican side and the Loyalist side, and apart from a handful of people in the Loyalist community, you know, I've been watching the debates and there's one or two people, and whether they're not shown to speak, but I've never seen them getting up the backside. And you know, it's a serious problem in the union side that people don't want to be identified. We're the same internationally. We've sent out such a bad image of ourselves down through the years that people do not want to be associated with a Loyalist cause. That's because of the representation we had in Paisley. I remember being in the States when Paisley went through a rampage down at the Gravai Road. I was in the States at the time, and the wife and I, that was when we were doing an elector. And the television came on, and all I seen was this carry on Gravai Road. And it wasn't a matter of them getting marched up Gravai Road, it was the way in which it was done. It was nothing in any way presentable that I, as a Yank, would have turned and says, yeah, I can support that cause. But it turned it off. And that's the difficulty that we have. We're not attacking the best people. We can't attack the best people because they don't want to be associated with what we project as people. And that's the problem. And we're seen, you know, as, oh, well, if we're going to be in trouble, we'll call it the UVA, we'll call it the UVF or whatever. And then we'll put them back into their rabbit holes again, and then we'll take over again. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's sheer exploitation.
And so members of the UVA and the UVF will go out on Thursday and they'll vote for the DUP.
I hope not. Yeah, I hope not. I really do hope not. I know that there will be, and it's up to the men themselves. But I've said to them, you know, work this out yourselves. In my own area, I said to our people, work this out. Who's the big barrier, and this is some of the people McCann I've talked about in the past. I couldn't vote for Imman as long as Imman holds that desire to become part of United Ireland. Now, I'm saying to Imman, you drop your desire to become part of United Ireland, and I'll drop my desire to continue the link with Britain. And let's meet in the middle, and let's build a whole new society. We cannot move until we deal with that serious problem.
Okay, Linda Walker.
Okay, thanks very much for your talk. I just want to draw on a couple of things. And one comment to tell me what related to what Cornwall said when we started was, I wonder who set the politics paper in 1974, because as a mature student, I was sitting in Queens. We had no electricity. And one of the questions was, do you think that Sunningdale would succeed? So I would take quite a lead there, you know. But I didn't hear any reference to the trade unionists who actually led the march back along with Len Murray. Friends of mine, like John Harrow, Barry Drew, and a whole number of people, Sammy Warden. And my partner at the time worked in the Ulster Museum. He was a Nipsa delegate, and he took notices down that were put up by the UWCP people, and he was threatened for that, physically threatened. That was Terry Gordon. But I have to say that the kind of government that you were supporting at that time, probably to some extent still are, and the demands were, I mean, the unions have the worst record for housing for people, ordinary people, right across the board, working class people. When it came to women's rights, which of course nobody took any notice of, I mean, if you look back now in retrospect, all the different things that they didn't support, including the right to choose, the question of the divorce, marital property, whole rate of things. I mean, these were the kind of politicians that were being supported at that time. And, well, I have to say, as a young person, we did quite enjoy the good weather and the barbecues that we had, because we didn't have the electricity either. But I think that the role of the trade union movement, I mean, and the kind of, if you like, what I would call the bona fide trade union movement, needs to be looked at. And I know that some people were advised today, but I mean, obviously now, I mean, some people are dead and not able to come here because of that, people like Sammy Warren. But anyway, just a couple of points.
Thanks, Linda.
Well, I think at the end of the day that, you know, yeah, most of the people involved in this strike were all shop stewards from the mainstream unions, or mainstream trade unions. And I was a senior shop steward at Kilkerra Power Station in the British Auction before I left. I was chairman of the engineering union in the city. I was the only Protestant elected in the city. So I depended each year when my nomination up to be re-elected, but they thought I was a good shop steward, and that's the reason why I was elected. But this was a different, this was a constitutional row. This wasn't an ordinary industrial strike. And it was very foolish, brave, but very foolish to try and, you know, go back to work. The feeling, if anybody had been looking at the feeling at that stage, they would have seen the feeling when the country was serious. You talk about democracy, we claimed at that time, as I said earlier on, 51% of the people voted to oppose the Sunny Deal Agreement. And yet it was just thrown to the one side, forgotten about. Now, 51% is a majority. It doesn't matter how small it is, it's a majority. And if there was 51% for United Ireland tomorrow, I'm sure the British government would try and implement it, and the Southern government, or maybe the Southern government doesn't want us anyway. So, you know, that was just cast to the one side. People felt bitter about that. But it wasn't... the trade union movement certainly was... I think courageous in many ways, but what was with silly, they must have known that at the end of the day that this was a constitutional stoppage. And could I just say one thing? I hear people talking from time to time, you know, about being brought up in a Protestant ghetto and how poor they were, and people brought up in a Catholic ghetto and how poor they were. I was one of the lucky ones. I was brought up in a mixed ghetto where we shared our poverty together, you know. And that has stayed with me all my life. So, you know, trade union movement, Protestantism and unionism, I wouldn't have voted. None of my family were in any of the orders at all. When I fought the 1973 election, there was advertisements and all, I'm sure Malachy will check this up, advertisements and all the local newspapers, the length and breadth of the country. Vote for Brother Willie Douglas, County Grand Master. Vote for Sister Sheena Cohen, wife of Brother Douglas Cohen. Vote for Brother John Brown, county chaplain. And I was the only other Protestant, and there wasn't a word about voting for me. Didn't say vote for Danny Barr, no. But I went in and I won a seat. What did I do? I joined the Orange Order. I joined the Orange Order. And in the 1976 election, there was no advertisement for any Protestant in the papers, because they knew if they had to put in for Brother Douglas and Brother Sister Sheena Cohen, they would have to put in one for me. And I was now a communist for daring to oppose what was happening in the country. So they couldn't put in an advertisement for me. And after the 76 election, I left Orange Order again. But I was just trying to prove to them, you know, this was the situation, the reality of it. And I went into the first count, along with John Hume, Sheena Cohen. So, at the end of the day, it's how we play the hand that we've been given. And I think that, you know, I retired in 1981 away from politics, and I said that I was going back home. And remember Morris and Ken came up to visit our work up in London, Derry, up in Derry, where we had 250 kids, and I wouldn't set up a workshop for the kids in the city and the waterside in opposition to Paddy Doherty's Catholic workshop on the city side. I went 3-5 miles outside the city in an old shed, and we got this place and we done it up, and we invited kids from all over the county to come in. And within 9 months, we had 250 kids. And somebody says, count them. And we had to do a count on them. We reckoned that all the time there's somewhere between 35 and 40% of the kids were Catholic and the other were Protestant. But that was the makeup of the area. But the kids were taken in there, and I told them, there's discipline in here. We're going to get you jobs. Over 93% of those kids were put into full-time jobs, many into apprenticeships. government unfortunately didn't like it for some reason, and we were closed down. But the whole concept was that we were trying to create what Northern Ireland should be like. No politics and no religion. Kids were coming to work together. I used to put them up on a roof, and if they had to be a scaffold, and if somebody had to have a rope, the Protestant was on the down the scaffold with a rope tied around his wrist, and the boy up top was a Catholic holding the rope. And he wasn't going to call him a Fenian bastard, he was going to call hang on there. You know. And that was the way in which we were bringing our kids forward. And to this day, we still see kids from that community still meeting together for a pint in the shop. And that's why I keep saying, it's what we do. It's what we do to our kids affects them, and it will affect this country for generations to come.
Question over there, comment.
I want to thank you for your fourth grade delivery intern. You've set us a lot of things, challenges there as well, like the delivery in terms of lots of reason. But in terms of trying to chart a course, a way forward, I think you've made it very clear we have to learn the lessons of the past and bring them with us and charting that course. You certainly talked about a lot of the lessons, you know, how the working classes get used, done, disposable. Try producing your own words.
Yeah.
I think that's the kind of thing that's given from you. Also, how it throws up certain political leaders or leaders were very collateral thinking or evasion. And that's fair enough. I think we're seeing things like that today. That a lot of that learning seems to be still relevant. When people are talking about dealing with the past, I think the biggest challenge is learning the lessons from the past. Why are we still unable to do that?
Well, I see several people sitting around the hall, and one particular Harry Donahue there, that when I set up the Messines programme, and Harry can speak for himself on this, to go back to the past is to find common ground, which we did in Belgium. We found a piece of common history that happened in 1917, and we have built a programme around that of equality. And as I say, Harry was one of the very first, because we took out what had been termed then senior people from both the Republican background and the Loyalist background, however you want to call it. Harry's still carrying on that work today because it affected him. It affected Protestants. Brothers sitting over here, Kenny Blair. And the first time I took Kenny out, we were standing at the main lane gate, and all of a sudden we heard these Uhlan pipes, and up through the gate, and you couldn't have written it, up through the gate came this tricolour. And Catholics. And I remember he said to me, what's the Fenian bastards doing here? Was to learn that Catholics led us alongside Protestants. It was that shared history that we've got to start building on. Because, and I keep saying to people, if you cannot embrace the spirit of the scenes, what the scenes means, how can you deal with the serious problems that we're facing in Northern Ireland? If you cannot go there and accept the fact that those graves are filled with Protestant Catholics. And I remember Harry saying the point at your delivery the day you graduated, Harry, that the German guns didn't discriminate between Protestants and Catholics. And that's exactly what we've got to go back to find that space for ourselves, collectively. And it's, for me, Messines, and I know that there's people trying to turn it into the, and Morris will remember the discussion we had when we set the thing up, to make sure it didn't become the opposition. I remember Morris's words, the Fenian falling symbol in opposition to the Ulster Tower. And we have tried to keep it up. We know there's others who would like to do that. Messines would be a Catholic space in opposition to the 36 Ulster space. And that cannot be allowed to happen, and I have fought that tooth and nail with the Town Council of Messines, and they support me 100%. I cannot be allowed to do that. This is the only place in the world where we have shared space, where we have a shared history. And if we lose that, then I think, you know, we did a disaster after the First World War was over when we didn't recognise that. Instead of that, we buried it. Nobody learned about it. Nobody learned about Protestants and Catholics fighting and dying side by side. And, you know, we have got to reinvent that. And you've got to have the vision that what Messines means. And no matter what troubles you get into here in Northern Ireland, go back to Messines. And I'm sure, you know, what's to say, Harry would agree on the work that he does. And that's the position that we adopt on all of this. And it's like, as I say, the First Nation people. They look seven generations old. You know, we're looking to see who's going to get elected on Thursday. And then come Friday, all hell will break loose again. And where are we? And I've stopped watching debates on television. I really have, seriously. It knocks me mad. Because it serves no useful purpose. It's not solving anything. It's just making people more embittered and more angry. And people are coming off. The television's turned off and they're going to bed. And they have to sit down and do a crossword to calm down before they go to sleep, you know. Seriously. And that's just how we're playing things out. That's crazy.
Okay. And Evan.
Thank you so much for this. Rare opportunity to come in contact with, if you like, this the raw material, and I say that as a dramatist, but I have a personal contribution to make, which is I was at the University of Ulster, as it was called, in 19, and I graduated in 73. Among the number of us who all graduated, there was a school that suddenly opened its doors to for young graduates for teaching jobs. And what was actually unusual about the school, it was Bushmills Grammar School decided to become comprehensive. The idea was that they wanted to bring their kids who were being, if you like, sent on buses all around the townland to Coleraine and were basically regarded as the Bushmills ones. And they wanted to unite their, if you like, secondary school children with their grammar school stream. And it was an entirely... I mean, I think you will recognise that the area, constituency-wise, of North Antrim is Paisley's constituency. But this isn't about that. It's about the fact that an intelligent board decided to bring two strands of their education, of their abilities together, so that they were kind of, if you like, bringing middle-class Protestant children together with working-class Protestant children. That's the only way I can put this. Because while the children were all one religion, they decided to make a huge step and employ a mixed teaching force from the university. And what they did was they added to the traditional grammar school staff by employing 9 new teachers. We were all graduates of the University of Ulster in that year. And what was remarkable about this moment is I remember driving through in a little mini through the strike was on when they were doing the interviews, and I thought it was an extraordinary thing that, and I got the job. And what I'm trying to say to you is that it seemed to me that there was another picture, just as the picture you gave us of you know, which is a very comprehensive picture. The other side of this was that there was another movement going on within the Protestant community at the same time that was completely enlightened about the education of the children. Sadly, I feel that opportunity was lost over from that period. I left in 1970. Actually, I left in the spring of 76. I left the country and went somewhere else, but the point was, at that moment, it's a very complex moment, that moment of that strike period. They knew they were appointing someone from a Catholic background. They knew, and in addition to the fact of appointing me as the English and drama teacher, they also had a teacher already on the grammar school staff who was a Catholic. And that's interesting, that was there. So it was kind of, he was the classics teacher. He taught Latin to the grammar school stream. Now, it seemed to me, I still remember to this day, and it's very important to me, that the committee that appointed me, there was the staff in the school that selected the people, and there was a committee made up of several clergymen, Church of England, Church of Ireland, Presbyterian. I learned this because you meet all the board, several councillors from the local area, and lots of educationists and staff, and some people from the University of Ulster. The point that I'm only simply adding to the fact that this was a very complex moment. It wasn't simple in any way, and that this seemed to me a very enlightened moment. The fact that I left is a if you like, it's about the events that follow
okay.
on from that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir. Any response to that, Claire?
No, I think it's a statement that I think I totally agree with, yeah. And everybody has their own experiences, and I think that I hate people saying to me, oh, I wasn't involved in the Troubles, you know. And I said, well, where the hell are we living? Everybody was involved in Tubbles, some shape, form, or fashion. Decisions we were taking day and daily, you know, were affecting the situation. And it's like, I remember, Morris will remember, he and I were part of a group that went to Sweden to look at Radabarna, the treatment of kids and stuff, and children's welfare and stuff. And there was a guy come on, a child psychiatrist, I can never tell the difference, the psychiatrist, psychologist, whatever there. But this guy come on to talk about bringing up kids, bringing up children, having children, what have you. And I remember saying, that guy scared the living daylights out of me. I mean, he scared me good and proper about the things that, how I thought I was bringing my kids up, and the effects of certain things that you do and all this, if you just take as a parent. And you just, you're not thinking about how it's affecting the kids, how the kids will turn out in future years. It was absolutely amazing. It scared the life out of me.
Huh?
Well, there you are. I made the point. But I remember the thing that brought hold me seriously was this, and I think it affects all of us. I remember saying to Morris, because he was head of Health and Social Service at the time, permanent secretary, and I said, you know, I'm a trained fitter and engineer. I had to take 5 years to serve my time before, you know, they would call me a fitter when I was in Merchant Navy and all the rest. But it took me 5 years of an apprenticeship before they let me become a fitter. And I got married, and I was a parent overnight. And yet, it's probably the most important job in the world to be a parent. And there's no training for it. You go to church and you come out, and you're a parent. And I thought, something seriously wrong here. This world's crazy. I think we should all look at ourselves and say, well, where's our own shortcomings? You know, how are we doing wrong? And I'd love everybody on Ireland to come with me to Belgium. Seriously. And I can guarantee you'll be a changed person being back. And I think that you look at people differently. You look at the real issues in life, and you'll try and correct the wrong ones, you know. And I think that if we start with examining ourselves first, and are we really fit to do this sort of a job or do that sort of a job, I think that's the important thing.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Ryan. I'd like to thank Glenn for his contribution here today. He was delayed, but very much worth it. If you can give us all a round of applause. Thank you.